Good evening. My name is Mark Raboy, and on behalf of Media at McGill, I welcome you to this public lecture made possible by the support of the Beaverbrook Canadian Foundation. It's a cliche to say that tonight's speaker needs no introduction, but your presence here tonight is the introduction. Angela Davis is many things to many people. She is an iconic figure, a woman who symbolizes certain values, certain ideals, a certain way of acting politically. Delighted is too mild a word to express how pleased we are that Angela could accept this invitation. She receives literally hundreds of speaking invitations every year and has a mind-boggling agenda of lecturing, writing, advising community groups, and advocating on behalf of activist causes in the United States and all over the world. She's been a fixture in the struggle for human rights and social justice for the past 40 years. There are many people here tonight who remember Angela from the 1970s, and many here who don't. And this is Angela Davis. Her appeal and her message travel across generational boundaries and across other boundaries as well. She is identified particularly with the civil rights movement in the United States, but she is also a leading advocate of equality for women, gay rights, prison reform, and economic equity. She is also the embodiment of one of the most cherished of universal values, freedom of expression. When Angela Davis speaks, she not only speaks her mind, she speaks truth to power. Angela is not known as a media critic, but we felt that she, of all people, would have something lucid, enlightening, and important to say about the media in today's world. The media landscape is changing dramatically, and if theory holds true, this should mean that society is changing as well. But I think we're going to hear tonight that social conditions have not changed quite as much as we would like to think, and that media, far from being the universally liberating force that some say they are more like extensions of human actors and consequently operate in all kinds of different ways. I had the opportunity to hear Angela's interview on CBC Radio this afternoon, and there she said something I thought was very important. Speaking about race, she said, "We need to have a public conversation on this topic." And when I hear the words public conversation, I immediately think of the role of media, how they can facilitate public conversation, or how they can also make public conversation more difficult, make it more like trying to engage with a serious issue in a noisy bar. I expect that in the next 45 minutes or so, we will hear a lot more about this. Angela Davis, you have our ear.
Technological problems. I wanted to project a couple of the video recordings in connection with the topic I've chosen this evening, but then I discovered that they were trying to set up an overflow room, and so even though I thought I had it together, we still waited. But thank you for your patience. And I would really like to thank Media McGill and the organizers of this series, Claire Auberge and Marc Raboy, for having invited me to participate in this series on race, media, and power. This is the first time I've been to Montreal in quite a number of years, and I would like to say that I'm really happy to be here. And Mark mentioned that there were some in the audience who might remember me from the 70s, and I look around and I don't see that many people who might have an actual physical memory, but you might have a historical memory, regardless of how old you are. And I should say that being here and having spoken to someone who came up and told me that his mother was the chair of the committee to free Angela Davis here in Quebec, made me remember what a powerful movement that was. And while I've never really been concerned about whether or not people know who I am or don't know, you know, some people, weren't you a singer? Or all of the comments about my hair. That doesn't really bother me that much. But I am concerned that there be a historical memory regarding the campaign that managed to secure my freedom against the powerful forces of the state. At that time, Richard Nixon, some of you have a historical memory of him, was president, and Ronald Reagan was the governor of California. And I was charged with three capital crimes, murder, kidnapping, and conspiracy. That is to say, I faced the death penalty three times. And regardless of the fact that I was innocent of those charges, it is very clear that had not it been for the massive mobilization of people all over North America, all over the world, Europe, Africa, the Middle East, Latin America, that I might very well now be sitting in one of California's four women's prisons. They abolished the death penalty during the time my trial was taking place. So I want to thank all of you who participated in that campaign, and I would like to say that it should inspire us to build transnational solidarity campaigns today. There are many causes that are calling upon us to come together across national borders, across lines that are drawn by race and gender and sexuality. So this evening, of course, my remarks are framed in relation to the case of Oscar Grant, who, as you all know, was killed by transit police in my home city of Oakland, California, on January 1st of this year. As a matter of fact, I live not very far away from the Bay Area Rapid Transit station where Oscar Grant was killed. So I have a number of reasons for choosing this particular case. But in relation to the overall theme of this series, I was interested in the proliferation of images that circulated in the hours and weeks after Grant's murder, and the way in which they highlighted the ubiquity of surveillance and the relationship between the media and surveillance. This case also highlights the uses to which multiple actors, the onlookers to the violence, political organizers, representatives on both sides of the criminal legal system, how they attempted to deploy emerging forms of new media. And of course, what has been so unique about this case has been the extent to which the actual killing was recorded by bystanders. We already have the example early on of Rodney King. And there was one video camera then. There were many, multiple cell phones. What, of course, is not unique about this case is that this is just one of the most recent examples of racialized police violence, like the Freddie Villanueva case here in Montreal. So I want to talk about the both the uniqueness and the fact that this case recapitulates a long history of racialized violence. And the case compels us to reflect on the long history of racial profiling by the police and the dominant media's complicity in this profiling, which stretches back to the period of slavery and persists into the 21st century. But to speak for a moment about the notoriety the case received as a result of the fact that so many onlookers recorded the scene of the shooting, the Washington Post, for example, pointed out that soon after the killing took place, the Oscar Grant shooting became the top ranked story on YouTube's news page. And let's remember that this happened on January 1st. It happened not very long after the election of an African-American to the office of president in the U.S., at a time when there were many declarations being made about the new post-racial society. And I thought it was very interesting that Barack Obama and his family chose Grant Park in Chicago to deliver the victory speech in the aftermath of the election, and that a young man bearing the name of the site he chose to declare a victory not very long afterwards was shot down by the police. And I don't know how many of you actually saw the coverage. How many of you saw at least some of the, or one of the video recordings? Okay. Well, I actually, this is what I was trying to do prior to the beginning of this. We were trying to get my computer online and then get it set up so that I could show you this, and I really hope it works. And I don't know whether that is the sound turned on? Is the sound turned on?
No.
You're going to try. Okay, I'll turn my sound way up and let's see if we get sound. All right, well, listen, let's see what we can do for now. Before actually returning to this case, I wanted to provide for you some personal background and political background. I wanted to talk a bit about my own interest in exploring this topic. I've been an activist in many campaigns against racism, and now I can say that for virtually all of my life, I've been involved in some way or another in these movements and issues and campaigns. And I guess now that I think back, I've also been aware, if not always in nuanced ways, but I've been aware of the role that the media have played in shaping ideologies of race. And for example, as a child, growing up in one of the most segregated cities in the U.S., if not the most segregated city, Birmingham, Alabama, like everyone else, I was so attuned to the absence of black televisual representation that the very appearance of a black person on the screen was cause to pause and stare at the television. As a matter of fact, in my family, and our routine was no different from that of other black families, if anyone happened to be watching television and a black person appeared, it did not matter in what context, the person would yell throughout the house and everyone would converge and regardless of whatever else they were doing, and watch this black person. This was always an exceptional moment to relish. But of course, there was a major exception to what you might call this mediated invisibility of people from black communities. And that was the hyper-visibility of black criminality. Everyone learned how to read certain images as imbued with racialized criminality, regardless of whether any texts accompanied those images. Most photographs of black people in the white press were mugshots. And we also learned how to be embarrassed whenever we saw such images. After all, it seems that we must have implicitly understood the attribution of criminality performed by those images. We must have understood that it was not only directed towards a particular individual whose mugshot it was, but toward all of us. I guess what I'm talking about is a process of racial profiling. And unfortunately, the legitimization of this racial profiling, even in communities that have been and are targeted by racial profiling. Of course, if we look at the history of photography, the history of photography is very much linked to the police. And the use of the photograph as evidence. And we still often operate under the assumption that a photographic or video image serves as evidence in and of itself. It cannot be contested. But of course, if we think about the Rodney King case, we know that that case was, that involved multiple police officers beating a black man, Rodney King, we know that the prosecutor, or rather the defense attorneys, were able to get acquittals for all the police officers by dissecting the video frame by frame and by leading the jury to believe that although Rodney King was the target of many assaults, that he was the one who was the aggressor. In any event, the history of photography linked to the police, the photograph is evidence. Already in 1850, daguerreotypes that were made for the use of Louis Agassiz, who was, of course, the Harvard professor and naturalist, and he had daguerreotypes done of many different people, types. He was interested in the ideal type, and among these were African slaves. And, of course, I had some images to show you of these daguerreotypes. But already then, they have the appearance of mugshots. The front view, the profile view, and this is, of course, before the development of police photographic technology. While Agassiz attempted to use these photographs in his process of racial evaluation, we can already see a criminalization process that is linked to this racialization. And that is what I want to talk about this evening. The point I'm making is that that photographic and video images have been heavily mobilized to suit the ideological purposes of racism and, of course, to aid the police. Now, in the U.S. And here in Canada as well, race has always played a central role in constructing presumptions of criminality. I could spend time telling you about my own experiences with Canadian immigration officials and being followed in stores in Canada. But anyway, I'm actually trying to talk a little bit about the history of this racialization of criminality, and the ways in which what you might call the symbiotic relationship between racialization and criminalization. In the U.S., in the aftermath of slavery, in the aftermath of what was called the abolition of slavery, because I think that what we're talking about today are the ways in which the sentiments of slavery still very much influence our lives and our institutions and our psyches. But in the aftermath of the abolition of slavery, former slave states passed new legislation that revised the old slave codes, the old laws governing slaves, in order to regulate the behavior of free black people in ways that were similar to those regulations that had existed during slavery. So instead of slave codes, we now had black codes. And these new black codes proscribe a whole range of actions, such as vagrancy, absence from work, breach of job contracts, the possession of firearms, and insulting gestures or acts. These were acts that were criminalized only when the person charged was black. And of course, many of these acts retain this historical memory of slavery and racism. With the passage of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, slavery and involuntary servitude were putatively abolished. But even in the Constitution, there is a significant exception to this. In the wording of the 13th Amendment, slavery and involuntary servitude were abolished, quote, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted. And according to the black codes, there were crimes defined by state law for which only black people could be duly convicted. Therefore, former slaves who had been recently extricated from a condition of hard labor for life could legally be sentenced to penal servitude. In the immediate aftermath of slavery, the Southern states hastened to develop a criminal justice system that could legally restrict the possibilities of freedom for newly released slaves. And so black people became the prime targets of a developing convict lease system, referred to by many as the reincarnation of slavery. I was actually thinking about this musical called Passing Strange, and there's this wonderful scene in which this white woman activist, Dutch woman, anarchist, says, "I want to be reincarcerated as a black man." So, in any event, the Mississippi Black Codes declared as vagrant anyone who was, quote, guilty of theft, had run away from a job, apparently, was drunk, was wanton in conduct or speech, had neglected job or family, had handled money carelessly, and all other idle and disorderly persons. So the point I'm making is that vagrancy was coded as a black crime, punishable by incarceration and forced labor, sometimes on the very plantations that had previously thrived on slave labor. And just a bit more about this history, because I think it's really important. We, you know, that history inhabits us, and we inhabit that history often without recognizing it. Mary Ellen Curtin did a wonderful study of Alabama prisoners during the decades following emancipation. And she points out that before some 400,000 black slaves in Alabama were set free, 99% of all prisoners in Alabama's penitentiaries were white. 99% were white. But as a consequence of the shifts that were provoked by the institution of the slave of the black codes within a short period of time, the overwhelming majority of Alabama's convicts were black. And this remains the case today. And she observes that, and I'm quoting from her book, although the vast majority of Alabama's antebellum prisoners were white, the popular perception was that the South's true criminals were its black slaves. During the 1870s, the growing number of black prisoners in the South further buttressed the belief that African Americans were inherently criminal and in particular prone to larceny. Now, Frederick Douglass wrote in 1883 about what he called the South's tendency to impute crime to color. I really like that notion of imputing crime to color. When a particularly egregious crime was committed, he noted, not only was guilt frequently assigned to a black person, regardless of the perpetrator's race, but he points out that white men then sometimes sought to escape punishment by disguising themselves as black. So they would commit crimes in blackface. And Douglass describes an incident that took place in Granger County, Tennessee, in which a man who appeared to be black was shot while committing a robbery. The wounded man, however, was discovered to be a reputable white citizen who had colored his face black. Now, the fact that crime continues to be imputed to color resides in the many evocations of racial profiling in our time. That it is possible to be targeted by the police for no other reason than the color of one's skin is not mere speculation. Now, Mary Ann Curtin, the historian whom I quoted before, has observed that many scholars who have acknowledged the deeply entrenched racism of the post-Civil War structures of punishment in the South have failed to identify the extent to which racism colored common sense understandings of the circumstances surrounding the wholesale criminalization of black communities. Even anti-racist historians, she says, do not go far enough in examining the ways in which black people were made into criminals. They point out, and this she says is partially true, that in the aftermath of emancipation, large numbers of black people were forced by their new social conditions to steal in order to survive. It was the transformation of petty thievery into a felony that relegated substantial numbers of black people to the involuntary servitude legalized by the 13th Amendment. And I'm thinking about what Kanye West said in connection with Katrina a number of years ago. He pointed out that many white people who took things from stores and so forth in the aftermath of Katrina were described as foragers, right? Foragers. Black people were, what did he call? The black people were looters. And as a matter of fact, I'm remembering this particularly amazing case of a 70-some-year-old black woman who had attempted to bring her disabled husband to a motel in order to escape the flood in a city right outside of New Orleans. And she had brought food from their house, and it was in the trunk when she was bringing this food into the motel. She was arrested by the police for looting and ended up spending something like a month behind bars before, as a result of a mass upsurge, the charges were dropped. So we still lived with those very real implications of slavery. And so I wanted to go on to point out that this historian, Marian Ellen Curtin, suggests is that it was not only the transformation of such crimes as petty thievery into felonies, which kind of helps us understand, you know, why in the U.S. there are so many black people behind bars today. There are 2.3 million people in U.S. Prisons, and the majority, the overwhelming majority of them are people of color, and many of them are in relationship to drug charges. But she pointed out that these charges were often fabricated. The charges of theft were often fabricated outright. And she said they, quote, also served as subterfuge for political revenge. After emancipation, the courtroom became an ideal place to exact racial retribution. So in this sense, the work of the criminal justice system was intimately related to the extra-legal work of lynching. Now, I was going to say a few words about the convict lease system. Alex Lichtenstein has wonderful studies on the convict lease system. But I wanted to mention these historical modes of linking racialization to criminalization, because I think they help us to understand how such a practice as racial profiling by police departments is not an irrational holdover from forms of racism that have otherwise been abolished. The constant monitoring, the constant surveillance of communities of color by law enforcement and penal systems, and oftentimes assisted by the media, continues to reflect the degree to which populations of color are seen as a threat. And so institutional resources that should be made available, I'm talking about jobs and education and recreation and health care, are replaced by repression, by law enforcement and imprisonment. Instead of seriously addressing the problems in our communities, policies and practices of repression are designed to get rid of the people who have the problems in order to be extricated from the responsibility of solving those social problems. Now, many of you have probably heard about a number of notorious cases that are similar to the Oscar Grant case. The case of, for example, of Abner Louima. Some of you may actually remember the media coverage of that. And I guess most of you are familiar with the case of Rodney King, right? And there have been other cases that have made headlines in the U.S. Taisha Miller of Riverside, California, who was killed by the police. Amadou Diallo, you remember that case. Robert Russ, LaTanya Haggerty in Chicago. And then Sean Bell, who was killed by police in New York the night before, I think, his wedding was scheduled to take place. And, of course, I've been talking about a lot of men who are the targets of police violence, but we shouldn't forget that there are many women who have suffered the violence of the police as well. And then, of course, the dominant media have participated in this process of, and I say dominant media because I don't want to say the media. And even within the dominant media, there are sometimes those who are attempting to work against the grain. But the dominant media have participated in this process of imputing crime to color. I had a really wonderful amateur video on a police killing in Bedford-Stuyvesant in 2004. If during the question and answer period we can figure out what's happening with the technology, we might be able to see it. But I wanted to take the Oscar Grant story as a media phenomenon and consider what demands have arisen from communities that have felt outraged at this killing. So what do you think would be the most obvious demand? Fire the officers. Okay, maybe I should explain, because does everyone know the circumstances? Okay. See, it would have been explained by video, but okay. All right. Oscar Grant was a young man, I think he was 22 years old, who had had some run-ins with the police, but he was actually, at the time of his death, he was a member of a I think the grocer's union, and worked as a butcher. So it must have been the butcher's union. And his union actually did a wonderful job of standing up for him. He had been out on New Year's Eve. Who went out on New Year's Eve? I mean, people do all kinds of crazy things on New Year's Eve. Most people drink too much, for one. I mean, that's almost normal, isn't it? Fortunately, if they were drinking, they weren't driving because they were on the BART, which is our, you know, Bay Area Rapid Transit. They were coming home, a group of friends, Oscar Grant and his friends were on their way home from a party. And apparently there was a little scuffle in the train. And the police, the transit police, got the message that there was a fight that had broken out. And, you know, rather than trying to figure out, well, is everyone okay? Is this an issue that really needs to involve an arrest? They chose people who looked a certain way and chose a number of them, including Oscar Grant, to arrest. And the video, the many video recordings that we've seen depict a group of police officers surrounding Grant, who was pushed down to the floor on his chest, on his stomach. And apparently he was being handcuffed when one of the cops, Johannes Messeli, stands up, pulls his gun out, and shoots him. And so, it's interesting that many of the people who took video recordings must have realized that this was something that was escalating. But he had no weapon. He was totally unarmed. The police had tasers and they had guns. And later, of course, there were those who said, well, he was the officer thought he was drawing his taser gun. But there had been a lot of media coverage over a case that had happened some time ago in which someone who was killed
was killed precisely because the cop thought he was drawing the taser gun, but drew his gun. And so they redesigned the taser so that it was much smaller and was yellow. And then what's interesting is that the recordings show him looking, pulling the gun and looking at it. So if he looked at it and it wasn't yellow, he shouldn't have shot it. But something happened. Something happened. And he shot him and killed him just right there, like that, with other cops surrounding him. And the question I'm raising is, what do you think should be done? Well, there will be a trial. But in terms of community demands, what kind of demand should one make? Oh, that's actually a good idea, you know, because we've talked about dealing with gun violence and getting rid of guns, but I think if we got rid of the guns that the police have, then we could easily get rid of all the other guns. But I think that's a very good idea. What I'm driving at is a dilemma that many of us experienced here. And I can't tell you how many of these cases I've been involved in. I can't count the number of cases. And I'm getting really, really tired of assuming that all you have to do is prosecute the individual policeman, a policewoman, because women aren't exempt from this. That all you have to do is identify the individuals as happened in Abu Ghraib, right? And then you point them out as bad apples, and the system continues to function as before. As a person who's been doing a lot of work around prison issues for many, many, many years, I consider myself an abolitionist, which is to say that I want to see eventually the abolition of imprisonment as the dominant mode of punishment. Get rid of the prison. And think about what would really begin to solve all of the problems that cause people to go to prison, whether we're talking about problems of education to deal with illiteracy, whether we're talking about jobs, or whether we're talking about the horrible cases of violence that people often commit. And it's, you know, one of the things I discovered is that the fact that we have this prison system completely shuts off serious thinking about how to solve some of these major problems. Because if you have someone who has committed a horrible act of sexual violence, say, and you think all you have to do is put this person in prison and you've solved the problem, you haven't even begun to understand how it is that a human being could commit such a terrible act against another human being. And in that sense, we allow this violence to replicate because we simply throw the person who's committed the violence into prison, and then we know that in many instances there's a generational dimension there, and so people continue to do it. It's been going on and on and on, and will continue. So in a sense, using the prison is a way of guaranteeing the reproduction of those problems. So what about Johannes Messele? If and many of us who are abolitionists talked about this, we say that if we are for abolitionists, can we in good conscience call only for the prosecution and imprisonment of this police officer? Or should our demands be focused somewhere else? I am much more interested in the embedded racism, the systemic racism, the structural racism that encourages individuals to commit such acts, regardless of why he did this, whether he thought it was a taser or not. You know, what convinced this man that it would be okay to shoot a young black person like that? I mean, I'm certain that if the kids came from one of the white suburbs, they wouldn't have reacted that way. But then on the other hand, I have to think that white kids are often the targets of violence, that police violence, structural violence that has a racialized history as well. As a matter of fact, I recently read that proportionately fewer black people are now arrested and or now convicted on drug charges. And so some people responded, "Oh, well, that's good that black people aren't doing so many drugs. Black youth aren't." Or Latinos, you know, stop doing so much, you know, whatever, whether it's meth or. But the thing is that if you look at drug use, it's pretty much the same across racial lines. As a matter of fact, drug use and drug trafficking. So if you assume that white kids do drugs at about the same rate as proportionally about the same rate as black kids and Latino kids, and then you go into prison to see who's in prison on drug charges, who do you see? So there's really something happening here. And that has to do with surveillance. That has to do, and this is why I think surveillance is really the key to understanding this whole symbiotic relationship between racialization and criminalization. Because if you live in a community that isn't subjected to surveillance, and I think the media often are complicit in that surveillance, or lack of it, considering who gets portrayed in various ways on television and the press, in the movies as the criminals, as the ones who are the drug users and the drug... But the point that I'm making is that the apparatus of surveillance is infected with racism. And so even when it does not claim as many black bodies as it may have previously claimed, the apparatus is still racist. Even though white kids may be subject to greater surveillance, there's still this racist character to the structure of the surveillance. I mean, does that make sense? Does it make sense? Well, the most compelling example I have to offer you, and I like to talk about this. I mean, it's actually a you know, about the death penalty. If you try to figure out, you know, why do we still have the death penalty in the U.S.? I mean, can you figure it out? Do you know why? The U.S. that claims to be the paragon of democracy, right? The only industrial democracy in the world that routinely uses capital punishment. Can you explain that? I mean, that this was supposed to have been obsolete centuries ago, actually. As a matter of fact, when the prison was introduced as the dominant mode of punishment, it was supposed to replace capital punishment and corporal punishment. That was the whole idea. The penitentiary, the place to be penitent, was supposed to be a humanitarian mode of punishment as opposed to cutting off people's limbs or putting them the racks or executing them. But we still have a situation where people are routinely executed. And in California, vast numbers of people are on death row, in Texas. And my explanation is that capital punishment was given a new lease on life precisely because it was used against slaves initially. I mean, there were states in the South where capital punishment became almost completely abolished for white people. When I say almost completely abolished, I mean that it could only be meted out to a white person for murder. But for black people, there were scores and scores of offenses that still were capital offenses. This was in the slave codes. Frederick Douglass pointed out that in Virginia at one point there were 77 different offenses that were capital for slaves and only one for white people. And so in the aftermath of slavery, racialization of capital punishment lives on. And I think now when we talk about the death penalty, it is a racist apparatus. It's not just the fact that it claims black bodies, but regardless of the race of the bodies it claims, it is still racist. So I want us to think about the extent to which the racism resides in the institutional structures. And I realize that I'm over time now. What time is it? It's almost there. I've been speaking for... Yes. We wanted to save some time for questions. So let me see if I can wind up. Just very quickly, I had some... I was going to talk about Obama. okay. I was actually going to raise, and the media, of course, played an enormous role in this case involving Henry Louis Gates. Right? Henry Louis Gates, the black Harvard professor who returns from a research trip in China only to discover that his key doesn't work. It got jammed in the lock. And the taxi driver was trying to help him unjam it, and someone called the police, right? Two black men are trying to break into a house. And I think that probably Henry Louis Gates was so surprised that he was the target of this kind of, police action that he probably just went off. And you know the story, right? Okay. Now, what I'm interested in is the way in which it was putatively resolved. Gates, Skip, as the president calls him, because they're friends, was invited to come to the White House along with the white cop, and I can't remember his name, so the three of them could have a beer. Now, I mean, first of all, the whole masculinist character of this, three men having a beer. And I don't understand why at least Gates and Obama did not recognize the implications of what they were doing. You know, it was as if this situation was something to be solved among honorable men. You know, no women involved. And that meeting at the White House marked the closure of public conversation about race, racial profiling, racism and the police. It should have marked an opening. And, you know, Mark Raboy was pointing out that if there is to be a public conversation, the media will have to play a major role in it. If you look, there's an enormous amount of coverage of that incident up until the time they sit down with their beer. Afterwards, the coverage focuses on what kind of beer they were drinking and who got beer that was made in the U.S. and who got beer that wasn't. I mean, it just totally disintegrated. What I think we need to acknowledge is that racism, that if racism is simply viewed as an anachronistic vestige of the past, then we fail to grasp the extent to which the long memory of institutions and I think institutions often have a much longer memory than individuals, and especially those institutions that constitute the intimately connected circuit of education and incarceration. The long memory of institutions continues to permit race to determine, for example, who has access to education and who has access to incarceration. While laws that while the laws that have been passed, because we talk about civil rights laws in the U.S., right? And there are so many, and those laws are good, but they've often had the effect of privatizing racist attitudes and eliminating the explicitly racist practice of institutions, the explicit racism of institutions. But these laws are unable to apprehend the deep structural life of racism, and therefore they allow it to continue to thrive. And this invisible work of racism not only influences the life chances of millions of people, it helps to nourish a psychic reservoir of racism that often erupts. And I don't know whether you've heard people say something, and then they say, "I don't know where that came from. You know, I'm not a racist." But there are many reasons why we should be exploring how strategies of we should be exploring strategies of decarceration that have a great deal to do with these understandings of the structures of racism and the structural character of racism. But I'll just say very briefly, I've been speaking all evening as if we can think about racism as something that is that can be isolated. But it's not. It's not isolated from gender issues and sexism. One of the things I've been talking about in the media since I've been here is the fact that transgender issues are some of the most interesting questions that we are now exploring in relation to the prison system, because trans people are more criminalized than any other group of people, and particularly trans people of color. And then when you think of the role that the prison plays as an apparatus that preserves racism, and that often functions according to all systems of segregation, racial segregation, but at the same time it's a great gendering apparatus. Because they're prisons for men, and then they're prisons for women, right? And so, what happens if you fall somewhere else? If you don't assent to that binary notion of gender, and you think that a person can be gender nonconforming, or a person can be a trans woman, or a trans man, or a transsexual. So what happens to all of those other categories? The prison shuts them out. And the way that it does, it shuts out conversation and thinking about so many important issues. So you see, this whole question of abolition is not just about getting rid of the prison. It's about allowing us to think in more nuanced ways about our lives. New openings, new historical conjuncture. I think this is a new historical conjuncture. I do think we have a new terrain, and I am glad that we elected Barack Obama as president. But I'm not happy about a lot of things. I'm not happy about his position on Afghanistan. I'm not happy about his position on immigrants and health care. At the same time, I could go on. I could do another lecture about the things I'm not happy about. But I want to encourage us to build communities of resistance and use alternative media and dominant media when possible to bring together academics and activists and artists and labor organizers and communities of resistance and of transnational solidarity that reach across boundaries of nation and race and gender and sexuality. Thank you very much. Okay, we have about 10 minutes for questions, but let me ask all of you, even those of you who are leaving right now, to go to YouTube and look up Oscar Grant, okay? And you'll see there are many, many recordings. So you'll see what we were not able to collectively witness tonight.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Some of you are already positioned at the microphones. I just want to point out, as Angela said, we have a very, very short time. So please keep your remarks short and to the point out of respect for the people behind you in the queue. Thank you very much.
Hello? Okay. It's working. Okay. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to listen to you. The problem, I want to bring back the debate to the problem of the media. And here in Canada, for example, both the English and the French media are owned by one or two people. So we have a problem of ownership and the concentration of the media into the hands of two or three privileged people it's not in their interest to tell us what's going on. What I find really aggravating and infuriating is that whenever we listen to the news or watch the news, It is dealt with as a horse race. Who's winning, who's losing, but never, never on the issues. What are the issues? What are the problems? So I'm sure it's the same way in the United States, but I don't know if they told you about the Polish man who came to the airport in Vancouver and the police shot him dead and he was not black. So, I mean, there's a problem with they're gun happy, I'm sure, the police.
You're absolutely right. Is this working? I guess what's most exciting during this period is that we do not have to depend on the dominant media in the same way that we once did. Back in the 60s and 70s, it was interesting that the media were all very conservative, but we knew how to attract their attention with the kinds of demonstrations and occupations and so forth we had, and that we figured out ways to use the media to transmit that message to people in other parts of the country, despite the fact that we were represented as negative. So, but now we have many other possibilities. And I mean, in the U.S., I like Amy Goodman and Democracy Now. Do you get Democracy Now here? So, yeah, and you know, even the Huffington Post gives us a different perspective. So we don't have to depend on the corporate media in the same way we used to. And we have to recognize the extent to which that the corporate media are complicit in the law enforcement prison industrial complex. So thank you very much for your question.
I'd like to make several comments. One is the whole question of immigration. The whole issue of immigration really in the United States is a racially induced immigration, because most of them is mostly opposed to the Mexican immigrants, mostly Latinos, and basically what we want to say is Spanish-speaking native peoples who are short, stocky, and brown. They're not going after the white Latinos from Cuba or the white Latinos from Argentina. And in fact, one of the issues was under Bush, Bush signed a special immigration accord to bring in 50,000 Polish nurses to serve in the United States, including with their relatives, that's 200,000 people. Well, the United Kingdom swept up almost all the nurses from Zimbabwe and Zambia. And when the person was a Republican HMO lobbyist, he was asked, why don't you bring in Filipinos and others? And he says, well, I don't even recognize my own country. I feel like I live in the Planet of the Apes. And this is the type of racism which you have. Sometimes it comes up to the fore. Sometimes it's racially concealed. And the other thing I wanted to make is the whole question of police violence. Many of these police people who are actually hired, many of them are not vetted psychiatrically or socially. Many of them sociopaths who actually get, in Montreal, for example, every year, 200 policemen are released or fired because of corruption or violations or theft. So many of this whole thing about, as you pointed out, the guy who shot the black person in the metro, in the subway station, these people are basically maybe racist, certainly, but they're also psychiatrically psychopaths, sociopaths who are actually hired until they're found out. And I think the communities should actually have some vetting process in the selection of the police who actually go in there.
Okay, all right. Two major questions. I think you're absolutely right about the role that racism plays in the whole immigration issue, and not only Mexicans and Central Americans, but also people who are or are perceived to be Arabs or from the Middle East or Muslims. And as a matter of fact, I remembered this statement that was made during a John McCain rally. You remember John McCain? during the campaign, and this woman got up at a town hall meeting trying to ask a question,
and she was referring to Obama, and she said, well, I've heard he's, and then she couldn't say, I think he's a, I heard he's an Arab, right? And then McCain said, no, he's a decent family man. He's a citizen. So in that exchange, you see, and I guess even Obama never really responded in a good way, because the the Islamophobia that has emerged, especially in the aftermath of September 11th, is really horrendous. Now, the other question on who was the other? I mean, you know, I think there are people who have psychiatric problems everywhere. But let me just say, let me just give you a succinct answer to your question. I don't dispute you, but I would not like to see the question revolve around what individuals bring into police departments. Because I think that often individuals are transformed by the culture of these police departments. And it's that racist culture that we have to acknowledge.
My question is on gender and Obama. So in your interview with Ice Cube back in 1992, if I'm not mistaken, he refused to acknowledge or even recognize the crucial and pivotal role of African-American women in American history. So my question will be about Cynthia McKinney's presidential candidacy. Putting aside the Obama media craze, would it be fair to say that just like Ice Cube back in 1992, the African-American community is still unwilling to accept black female leadership?
Well, you know, first of all, I appreciate your comments and your critiques, but I also try not to generalize because while gender issues are major, and particular issues of gender identification and issues of sexuality are major, I don't know whether we can say there's a black community anymore, a single black community. There are multiple black communities. And so I try to shy away from characterizing the black community as such, because that would mean I would have to bring Clarence Thomas together with Cynthia McKinney, and I mean, it's just too much. But Cynthia McKinney is an incredible political leader, and I'll tell you a secret. I voted for her in the primaries because I was I'm a registered Green Party member, and she was running in the primaries, and she won the primary, of course. But we have to begin to address the question of gender and the gender and race together, and you know, we thought that when Obama was elected, and he came with this wife named Michelle Obama, who was, before he began his campaigns, a much more powerful figure than he was. As a matter of fact, on Inauguration Day, I was in Chicago because the University of Chicago hospitals, where Michelle had been vice president for a long time, invited me to come and speak. And they told me, they said, well, yeah, you know, Barack used to come around, and we would say, oh, isn't that Michelle's husband? You know? Isn't he the one who teaches over at the law school? unfortunately, I think that
I mean, I'm speculating about this, but I think that the handlers have caused her to be less outspoken than she would have been. But I'm hoping that that she'll be a little bit more radical than him. But thank you.
We can take two more questions. We'll take one on this side and one on that side. And please be very...
As you wish. Okay.
Okay. Okay. And Angela is suggesting that we combine the questions. If you can be very, very brief, please. We'll take three or four, and then Angela will have the last word.
And then I'll try to answer them all together.
I wanted to ask briefly about Barack Obama promised to close Guantanamo Bay when he came in. I think by January 2010, and he's since pushed back that date and has even made public comments to the effect that it was naive to set that deadline in the beginning. So I wonder if you could talk about the intersections of incarceration and immigration issues, which you touched on earlier.
As an organizer, what would you add to your seminal book about gender, race, and class from the experience of trying to bring together communities on these crucial issues you're working on?
I want to know what you think about Beyonce being cast as you in the biopic.
That's a tough act to follow. Some of you know me. I'm James Cockcroft of the International Committee to Free the Cuban Five, and I want to give Angela a chance to address the transnational issue she raised in her lecture with using the Cuba Five, perhaps, as an example. Thanks, Angela.
When you were talking about the Oscar Grant case, you mentioned about the some of the contradictions that came up in the campaign. Someone in the back yelled out, one of the men should be abolishing police. And I think a lot of us who struggle against police brutality, racial profiling, police violence of all kinds, deal with that issue. I'd be interested in knowing what kind of initiatives and campaigns that you're aware of that actually deal with alternatives to dealing with the police in our own communities.
All I really want to say was thank you for all the work you have done in the past.
Thank you. Okay, let's see. One, two, three, four, five, six. You know, one of the things I realized when Obama was elected was that probably people were going to project, you know, all of their desires and all of their powers onto this one individual. And we cannot expect him to change the world. We cannot even expect him to close down Guantanamo. And so it means that what we need are movements around all of these issues. He needs to be pressured. He needs to be compelled to close down Guantanamo. Yeah, that's the way I would answer that question. And I would say that, you know, what excited me most about the election of Barack Obama was not so much the individual, although he's a very charismatic man, and you know he's very intelligent, and I'm no longer embarrassed because you know for 8 years I was really embarrassed, even though I didn't support Bush, who I hear is coming to town when is it? Yeah. I didn't know he was making public appearances like this. So I guess he's going to get a welcome from people here in Montreal. But yeah, at least I'm not embarrassed because I used to be so embarrassed. You know, how could we have allowed a person like that to become president? I mean, he wasn't elected, but anyway. But what excited me so much about the
Barack Obama campaign was the fact that so many people came together, and it was primarily young people. It was young people who drove that campaign, who are responsible for the fact that we did this thing that was really unprecedented in history. So that's really where the praise should go. And we can't forget that. You know, we forget about what enabled the election, and we think about the one individual. So, yeah, close down Guantanamo, bring the troops home from Afghanistan, health care for all immigrants, regardless of their status of being documented or undocumented, and so on. And I guess I would say to the person who asked about what I would do now in terms of bringing communities together around gender, race, and class. It's a book I wrote in a long time ago. And it was a first effort to try to understand, you know, how we work these issues together. And, you know, we can't really, although we analytically separate gender and race and class and sexuality and nation and so forth, they don't live in that isolated form. They always live within a very messy environment so that gender is always raced. When Hillary Clinton talked, maybe I shouldn't talk about that. But, you know, it was so bizarre during the campaign. Should a woman be president or should an African-American be? I said that recapitulated the whole, 19th century women's rights assumption that the women, there was this wonderful book that was written in around 1981. It was called All the Women Are White. All the blacks are men, but some of us are brave. Okay, the next question about Beyonce. no one has ever asked me. I heard about this through, on the internet and from people like you, so I have no idea what's going on. Someone asked me about Halle Berry today at a media interview that I did. Like I said before, I don't really care how I get represented individually. I mean, I do, but that's not the most important thing. What's most important for me is to retain that historical memory of victory. And in my case, it did not seem possible. It did not seem possible that I was ever going to get out of jail or escape the death chamber. But the fact that people came together all around the world and stood together and said no meant that when I was in that courtroom, I was not standing before that judge and that jury by myself. There were millions of people who came with me. And that is why that victory was possible. And so I want that. You know, whoever, if there's a movie, I want the movie to be about that. You know, because I wanted to inspire people to find ways to build those solidarities or new forms of solidarities today. That is, and however I look, I don't care. And of course, as James Cockcroft pointed out, one of the important cases today is the case of the Cuban Five. There are five Cubans who were arrested in the U.S. as terrorists, and what they were actually doing was trying to prevent terrorist assaults on Cuba. And here in Canada, you have a different relationship to Cuba. You don't have the same embargo. And this is another thing Obama to do. This is another thing I want him to do. He could declare the embargo over right now. That would be very easy. And he could also allow people in the U.S. to recognize what an incredible health care system people in Cuba have. You know, Michael Moore, you know, already gave us a glimpse in Sicko of, you know, when he took the 9/11 survivors over, and they got treatment in Cuba. And I'm really looking forward to his capitalism. Is it tomorrow? Yeah. And then, okay, the last question was a thank you, but that the question on abolishing the police. Yeah, I think. But let me just say something about abolitionism. It's not so simple. It's not just about getting rid of a particular institution. It's not just about dismantling prisons. It's not just about dismantling the police. And we learn this from the history of the abolition of slavery. And so slavery was abolished, but it wasn't. Right? It was abolished, but all of the conditions that would have permitted former slaves to participate fully in the politics, economics, and social life, civil life of our society were never created. And therefore, we're still haunted by slavery today. So I'm not interested in that kind of abolition. I'm interested in the kind of abolition that seeks real solutions to the problems that these institutions try to but cannot solve. And so, therefore, I recognize that abolitionism, we're talking about abolishing prisons, abolishing the police, we have to think about a very different kind of justice system, one that's not based on revenge, one that's not based on vengeance. And that means we also have to think about our own social relations and how we reenact, how we sort of walk around with the courtroom in our head all the time. You know, we walk around with the state in our head, as one of my colleagues said. And when we think, when someone does something bad to us, we try to figure out how to get back at that person, which is exactly what is done in the adversarial atmosphere of the courtroom and by sending people to prison. So it's really complicated. It's about getting rid of the institutions, but it's about finding new ways of relating to one another, new institutions, and I know you all are, yeah, we have to end, but I just wanted to thank the young man who said, thank you. That was really sweet. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, Angela. Thank you all. And a young member of the audience who is visiting us here at McGill from Italy did this, which is a very old media representation of you. Unfortunately, we can't project it very well, but it's very, very good,
it's
don't
not
you
that
think?
Old. She has to,
no, it's an old media.
Old media representation.
Yeah. Okay.
See ya. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you. Good night.